I'm not hearing you on my input. Therefore, I think I'm also getting some form of desensitization. Over to you, Eric, KQIW.
2 Golf Hill, Charlie's going to leave the net.
Then you're having a problem because I should be pinning the needle.
WA2CDL.
Go ahead, Andy.
I'm hitting. I've been watching it on my monitor. Repeat is coming in here -72. It's been steady. It has not changed.
I'm confirming that as well, Andy. KQ2QIQ.
Okay, then I'm getting either a failure of my front end or desensitization. Alrighty. However, the 375 going off the air, you've confirmed some of that. The 375 on the air at this time, Eric?
I gotta go turn over there, give me a second. C2 Golf there, Charlie, he's gonna leave the net.
Yeah, Dick, 375 has been on all the time, it has not dropped. I'm listening to it.
Yeah, I see it, it's fine.
Okay, so, you had an error when you thought it was off earlier, Eric. Alrighty, I'll stop worrying. I'm hearing the machine, I'm just not getting as strong a signal from it. Now, I know, Wes, you had a further question with reference to impedances. When it comes to any transmission line of any impedance, you can put any load on there you want as long as the line has got low enough loss, and as long as you know the length of the line by way of a Smith chart, by graphic solution, or by an equation, you can know exactly what impedance you're going to get at the input. And if your antenna tuner and your device that does the balancing at the shack end, you have to start over with your 50 ohm unbalanced impedance out of your transmitter and go through some kind of a balancing network in order to feed open wire line. But as long as you've got that balancing in the shack, and as long as you've got enough antenna tuning range, all of that can work with very high efficiency. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I believe this provides the answer. The only thing is that the interesting fact is that physically, if you think about the wavelength going on the cable, you could have a few scenarios when you have a maximum at the input and maximum at the output, and zero in the middle, let's say. You could have a minimum in the input, minimum in the output, and maximum in the middle. Or you could have a multiple wavelength in the coaxial cable, depends on the frequency, and coming with the same result. N2XJN.
I just confirmed that my other receiver is getting full strength, so I've got a partial failure of this particular receiver. Yes. Any impedances can be made to work. So there's no magic. Once you've got a low loss transmission line, like many of the kinds of open wire lines, you can feed almost any kind of antenna from any kind of transmitter, as long as you've got the right kind of impedance matching devices, that can all work. And the antenna itself can be a non-resonant antenna, and you force it into resonance by the way you tune the signal going into your antenna tuner, the way it feeds the open wire line. So you get a lot of capability, a lot variations in the way you make the system work with open wire line. I think you had another question on that subject, which go ahead and word it one more time. N2XJN, KQLIW.
No, what I wanted from you is, for the listeners, you have a thin wire, 50 ohm, I'm sorry, 200 ohm, a flat ribbon cable, which is the open line, and the one that was used for the TV, 200 ohm, with the balloon. Right? Now, you have a big one with a big space on it. So the question would be, we're actually, the space is of importance between the two wires in open line.
Okay, I think I see what you're asking. In the case of 600 ohm open wire line with the great big spacing, it is arguably the lowest loss line that you and I can easily afford, other than engine 5/8 Andrew Heliax with a dry nitrogen fill to it. 600 ohm open wire line is the lowest loss line you're ever going to see. 450 ohm line, a little bit closer spacing, tiny bit lower, lower in performance, a little bit higher in loss. The 300 ohm ribbon twin lead, quite a bit higher in loss. There are people who used to use 300 ohm twin lead for their television set because at the time it was the lowest loss line they could buy. And along came foam-filled RG58, RG59, RG6, which has lower loss because of the foam-filled than the typical 300 ohm twin lead ribbon wire. So you get various losses, and a part of the extra loss of 300 ohm ribbon wire, let me drop it. The extra loss of the 300 ohm classic television twin lead is that the wires are skinnier in diameter, they're closer together, and there's a lot more plastic between those wires. The plastic itself has a little bit of loss to it, particularly when there's water droplets on the plastic, or particularly when it's older and it's got a whole lot of voids in it which suck up water. So the fact that you're using open wire line doesn't automatically give you the low loss. In the case of 300 ohm ribbon wire, it's not so great. The 600 ohm stuff, the wide spacing 600 ohm open wire line, you have to go a long way to find anything lower in loss than that at HF frequencies. N2XJN, KQRIW.
I believe that this is all the questions that I have. Yeah, interesting is how far the history of antenna evolved. About 100 years. Amazing is also how people were able to get to the antenna theory, antenna practice in 1920s. And to see it.
Yeah, a lot of the antennas in the 1920s were simple wire-like things. In some cases, the wire was... I'm disturbing my wiring here, looking for what's going on. In some cases, there was no transmission line at all because the ham shack was in the third floor of a wooden house. The transmitter sat on the middle of a wooden table. And one half of the dipole went out the north window and the other half of the dipole went out the south window of the attic of the house. No transmission line at all. And you get a lot of freedom out of, a lot of freedom in the ways you can feed that particular system. But along came things like the Bruce antenna, the Sturber curtains, the HJK antennas, and life started getting more complicated. We've now got something like 5,000 kinds of antennas, in my opinion. Not everyone's going to agree with that. But they all have one thing in common. They all have to resonate the radiating system in order to radiate well. And the resonance in some cases is taking place in the Pi network, in some cases it's taking place in the antenna tuner, and in some cases it's taking place in the antenna itself. As long as the whole system resonates, it can radiate with very high efficiency. And the infinitesimal dipole still amazes the hell out of people. You can make a dipole that's a 1/16 of a wavelength long out of low loss materials and properly fed. You can get 95% efficiency out of that system and have the full amount of antenna capture area when you're receiving, even though the dipole is only a 1/16 of a wavelength long. Of course, that sounds crazy. Yes, it's going to take a lot of range out of your antenna tuner to feed that, and as such, you're probably going to end up with a pretty high Q. But that antenna located in the right place even though it's way too small, can work extremely well. Now, I know that Rich wanted to ask us a question. N2EO. Go right ahead, Rich. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Before that, did you have a chance to read that email that I sent you about Mr. Furrer dream about replacing taxi with EM drives? He's the inventor of EM drive penetration.
Yes, this EM drive is quite controversial. There are a few people saying that it's a farce. There's a significant number of people saying, I'm getting a small amount of thrust out of it. 1.6 millinewtons per kilowatt is one of the numbers being quoted. So this closed cylinder thing, this thing that looks like a horn antenna, operating at UHF frequencies, without squirting out any material, this is a kind of a rocket engine which has no exhaust. It gives you a small amount of thrust. And various people, a few people have trouble confirming it. Quite a few of the experimenters are confirming some thrust, including a NASA experiment. If it's real, it's an interesting antenna, but where is the thrust coming from? It's violating Newton's third law, action and reaction. There is no reacting material leaving the thrusting engine, and yet it appears to give thrust. And so whether or not enough peer-reviewed articles on this have occurred up till now is an interesting question. So I presume you've seen quite a few people who have got the faith in the EM drive rocket engine. Is that true, Wes? N2XJN, K2LIW?
Yeah, I've been interested in many things around. I don't see any violation. Action observation using the third law. I don't see any violation here. Don't have to have material. Do you have material in space? No. Do you have to pull any material, any particles? No. So, action causes the reaction. That's my opinion. So, it's it.
Up until now, do you know of any engine, any rocket engine, that produced thrust without emitting material? Do you know of any rocket engine up till now that gave you thrust without emitting material? And if your answer is no, then this is a great big break with the usual tradition. And so this is a very unusual device that's going to take a lot of confirming before everybody jumps on that bandwagon. Over to US, K2LIW.
Definitely my answer is no, but I don't deny the fact of this being extremely special, but I deny the fact of violation of laws of thermodynamics and so on.
Okay, you see a method by which it could work, and so not everyone sees it. So we're going to have to wait until a lot more testing takes place and a lot more confirmation. Until somebody really builds one and puts it in space, the fact that some of the experiments have been done in a chamber running at air pressure and some of the experiments have been done in a chamber running at a vacuum, and in some of those experiments they got thrust in both cases, it's still a little bit mysterious as to where the thrust is coming from.
The thing that I wanted pointing here was something else. So say we have 0.1 millinewton per kilowatt. It's 1.2. 1.2 plus minus 0.1 millinewton per kilowatt. So let's say the measurement of the impulsive thrust that was provided to NASA was approved, and let's say the paper is available, the frequency was 1.937 of megahertz, let me drop. But we're dealing with microwaves, and due the course of a discussion and watching inventors due to comment. He's envisioning the possibility of replacing taxi with aerial vehicles based on that. And my question is, if we completely forget the amount of power needed for it, at the bottom of it, you have a huge microwave oven. How can you start and stop and drive, even vertically, and you have a city below or just around? Nonsense. Or correct me if I'm wrong, and fix it.
One of the best written of the articles that you presented to me, when I open up the article and you look at the curve, you see at the instant they turned on the microwave source for this EM drive, there was a slow rise in thrust being created. And then when they turned off the RF energy, the thrust kept going for quite a few more seconds. The signal in the horn had disappeared, and yet they're still getting thrust out of it at some later number of seconds. That's not easy to explain what's going on there. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Well, isn't that due to the velocity factor of the particle, or the nanoparticles? Nanoparticles, okay. What do you think, Dick?
And almost any kind of resonator that I know about, at the instant you turn off the transmitter, within a few nanoseconds, the signal disappears. So, most likely, you turn off the transmitter, the signal in that horn-shaped device is gone, and yet for the next 5 or 10 seconds, you continue to get thrust. It's a sloping thrust that's falling off, but you continue to get thrust. Where's the thrust coming from? N2XJN, K2RIW.
Oh, you're asking how does the EM drive work? The EM drive is what is called RF resonance cavity thruster. So, there are several hypothetical machines that could be assigned to this model. It is definitely based on the magnetron push microwaves in a close, truncated cone. We could think that this is a cone. Then push against the short end of the cone and propel craft forward. So it's a typical action and reaction. You have to have particles thrown. Now there is a significant difference between particles and photons. There is also an interesting factor to note. I believe Dr. Roy, if he is here, he would be interested to join us. Let me jump. Okay. Is that if we think about an electron, you could see an electron as mass or massless particle. Does that have anything to do with that? I have no idea. I would be glad if you make your comment and to it here.
I know that the RF cavity of that feed horn shaped device, the signal bouncing around in there at resonance, when the transmitter is on, you get a nice big strong signal, and you believe that bouncing against the narrow end is what's creating the thrust. At the instant I turn off the transmitter, if I had a probe in that cavity, I would see the signal in nanoseconds disappear. In a few cycles of the signal bouncing around, without the transmitter being turned on, that signal in that EM horn is going to disappear very rapidly. And yet the curve that he presented, it continues to give thrust for the next 5 or 10 seconds. If the signal in the cavity is no longer there, and you're still getting thrust, that's a very spooky thrusting device. That curve is what's bothering me. I know the signal disappears as soon as the transmitter is turned off. Therefore, the signal in the horn is disappearing. Where is that thrust coming from for the next 5 or 10 seconds? N2XJN, K2RIW.
What's the possibility that they're heating a gas inside that horn?
With microwave, you can heat not only a gas, you can heat with anything you want. And that's a valid question. With low energy inputs resulting from fuel, micronewtons. What is micronewton? Think about weight of the penny. So that's how big trust we're talking about for the huge stuff. So that was a good comment, I believe. Microwave can heat. The heat could be a part of the equation. What do you think?
Repeater, time out.
The experiment, when it's run in a vacuum, there is no air being heated inside the horn or outside the horn. So the experiment, one of the experiments, it was run in a vacuum. By the way, a penny, the older pennies when they were copied, measured 3.1 grams. The modern pennies are 2.5 grams. And there's 221 grams of force in a newton. So a penny is not micrograms. One of the articles calls a penny micrograms. A penny is milligrams. So there's a mixture of units going on here. And various people who ran the experiment get different amounts of thrust. They don't all get 1.6 millinewtons per kilowatt. Some of them get numbers bigger, some of them get numbers smaller.
1.2.
0.2 was one of the well-documented articles. But some of the articles got other very different thrusts. Barry, you had a comment on it. N2MB, K2LIW, go ahead, Barry.
Paul March and James Lawrence, and that's the Johnson Space Center. And that was, let me read it.
Dick and Toledo, I'm very upset. Wesley always takes over the show, and he'll talk all night.
Yeah, Barry, you had a comment. N2MB, K2LIW, go ahead, Barry.
Yeah, I'm thinking that it might be a liquid there. If you put a liquid in there and it got warm, it would expand. It would have thrust. That's the only thing I can think of.
No, let's speak about no liquid, just the heat. In vacuum, you have a heat transmission as well. You could have a full vacuum, 100%. You're going to have a heat transmission as well.
Yeah, Barry, there was no liquid, and some of the experiments were running through a vacuum. Let's go over to Rich. N2EL, K2LIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, let me get to B. All right, well, I'm sure you heard my comment, and it does not have to be repeated. Dick, I've got two pieces of information on people that drive cars with disabilities. The first one is one of us driving had a choice, either ham radio plates or handicap plates. There was no option for both. So I contacted Motor Vehicles many years ago. I said to them, it was on an email, I believe, it's a long time ago, and they said, I am a ham radio operator, and I'm disabled. Why don't you have a check call for both? By the way, both ham radio plates are not considered vanity plates. They're free, and the same with handicap plates. Anyway, they made a change, which was much to my appreciation. On their website, they put a third choice. They apologized to me. They said it was simply an oversight. They said I would need a doctor's letter, and I did get the Lady Liberty plates with the Lady Liberty off to the left. In the center, it had my call letters and 2EL, and on the bottom, it said handicapped, and I got something else for the net. But that checkoff is probably still there. You need a doctor's note. And I got something else, same subject.
Congratulations, Rich. It sounds like you made that change. I'm amazed that no one else has requested that up till now. How recent was this event? How long ago did you receive this plate with Lady Liberty, your call letters, and disability all on the same plate? Is that something that just arrived in your mail very recently? And how long ago did you make that request? They're a big bureaucracy, and I'm amazed that they can respond in 6 months. N2EO, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, it's probably 15 years ago. I don't drive anymore because I lost both my legs due to diabetes. When I get resituated, you know, I'm moving. I want to maybe get a car with hand controls, but they require me to get familiar with them and be retested. But I got something else I did. The answer is, if you have a medical problem and you want to drive, and there are things available, but you have to be proactive and go after them.
Okay, you gave us a tease, but you didn't tell us what is the subject. There's something else you can go after. What is that, Rich?
All right, I'll tell you right now. As you know, and as many other people know, I have a neurological disorder. It's a genetically based disorder. My father had it. It's called Tourette syndrome. Today, a lot of people know about it. Years ago, they didn't. And some of my symptoms were constantly being misconstrued by people on the road. They would go into road rage, or I'd be pulled over by a policeman thinking I was on drugs. Anyway, one policeman one day who did pull me over, I consider it my lucky day. He said to me there were exempted window tint permits from the state of New York motor vehicles that will allow me to have darker than normally allowed window tint. So I contacted DMV about that. They gave me stickers for each window. One sticker went on by the registration sticker on the windshield. Let me let it reset. On all the side windows and the rear window, they said it had to be, each sticker had to be in the top middle of each window. Then I had not one, but two layers of tint put on, which are absolutely legal because you can see the Wyndham New York State shield. It said window tint exempt. And I had first mirror tint, and over that they put dark regular tint. It took me a while to get used to driving with all that tint. I put on extra driving lights, which cost about $40 for the kit in an auto supply store, the halogen lights. So I use those. I can drive to Southern State, the LIE, everywhere with no problem, and I had no further problems.
What's not clear, Rich, is that a person with Tourette's, I think a certain amount of the symptoms are controllable with the right kind of pharmaceuticals. You didn't say it, but the implication is that symptoms are controllable with tint of the window, or is the tint of the window so that other drivers cannot see you, the driver. So I'm not quite sure what the tint is doing in this case. Over to you, Rich, K2LAW.
Okay, Dick, I'll try and make myself clear. It allowed me privacy, so other drivers couldn't see me, but I could see them. This way they didn't go into road rage. It gave me privacy. Now, anybody with an eye condition or anything else may be subject to bright light from the sun. Any reason, not just Tourette's, could get these window tint permits, and all they need is a doctor's letter. There was a form I filled out, and they came right in.
Now, one of the things that we non-Tourette's people don't know is that does a bright light coming in the windshield aggravate Tourette's, and that with the tinted windshield, not only are you getting privacy, but the symptoms of the Tourette's are lessened by the tint of the windows? Is that what you're saying, Rich? K2LAW?
No, Dick. What I'm saying is my symptoms, tint or no tint, were misconstrued, and some motorists, not everybody, would go into road rage. And I was afraid. So, attempts stop that. But I'm also saying for other medical conditions, maybe eye conditions, that would help people. That's why I'm bringing it up. I want to help people.
So I think you're saying a significant amount of tint under certain conditions is legal as long as you've got these extra stickers. And that's something that at the Motor Vehicle Bureau, if you make the right request, you can get those stickers and you can legally put on quite a bit of tint is what I think you're saying, Rich. Over to you for confirmation, K2LAW.
That's correct, Dick. There was a law, I don't know exactly how it's worded. Normally you can put light tint where people, the police, can still see you. With these tinted, window tinted exempt permits, you're allowed to go much darker. And you can get them from the state of New York, DMV. You have to fill out a form and get a doctor's letter to back you up.
How do they define the amount of tint that you're allowed to use in these conditions? Is that defined, Rich?
With the window tinted exempt, it is not. They just want you to be able to see out the roads so you don't hurt somebody. The window tint allowed by law with no exempt, I'm not sure how they word it, but it's only supposed to be very light tint, more for style. I was going to say something else, but like I say, I learned this from a police officer, and I had no idea. How was my lucky day?
Yeah, he sure does sound like a nice guy. That incident with that police officer, was that like 5 years ago, we were Rich?
I lost track of time because, you know, I lost my right leg. Now I lost my left leg due to diabetes. And you know I'm moving. So once I get situated, I want to buy a modified vehicle with hand controls. I got to get trained and retested. But that's a subject for another day. What I would recommend from my experience, you can go to any automotive supply store and buy an extra set of halogen driving lights. They come in a kit for about $40. They have studs on the top, on the bottom. You have to drill holes in your bumper and mount them. They come with a switch, so you can start something you put under the dash, so you can have them on or off. They come with wire, they come with everything. Like I said, about $40, and if you have the window tint permit and go beyond what's normally allowed, I personally recommend it.
Question, comment.
Yeah, that sounds like a good suggestion. There's at least two people trying to make further comments. Go ahead with the first one.
E2FIU.
You got it, George.
Yes. Does the over-gesticulating from the syndrome, does it affect the ability to drive, number one? And number two, are these additional...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You timed out. You're going to have to repeat your question, George. Go ahead.
Okay, my first question is, number one, does the over-gesticulating from the condition of Tourette affect your driving ability? And secondly, are these additional lighting systems that are added to the car affecting other drivers' ability to see?
Yeah, I see the possibility that they could be a little bit blinding, depending on how they're aimed. Over to you, Rich, for some of those answers. N2EO, K2LAW.
Okay, Dick. Well, I never had a problem driving. I'll give you an example. I never got a moving violation at all. You know what I got a violation for, George? From a Chinese lady cop, she gave me a ticket because one of my taillights were out. That's the only ticket I ever got, so I think that answers that question. The lights did not blind other drivers because I aimed them a little bit down. After being on the roads, the parkway, I adjusted them down a little more. They wouldn't bother anybody. But they were still aimed out far enough that I could see the road fine.
I think there are people, even without disabilities, that sometimes buy the extra lights for their car. And I guess particularly some guys with trucks really do that up big. There was another person who wanted to make a question or comment. Who was that? K2LIW. I thought I heard another question. Very fine, Rich. I thank you for that information. That's quite unusual, quite surprising that those accommodations by the Motor Vehicle Bureau have been made for people with a disability. So lots of people say some terrible things about the Motor Vehicle Bureau, but maybe those folks are not all bad. I think it's time we go over to the space report. One of the things I wanted to report is that the latest issue, the February issue of Scientific American, for people who are space-oriented, has two very good articles. One is talking about the so-called theory of inflation of the universe. That's becoming in doubt. I've always been kind of doubtful about that one. This period of inflation right after the Big Bang, where the material moved out at many times the speed of light, that's very hard for me to accept. However, the second article is even more important. Let me drop. And the second article represents a whole bunch of experiments they've done on mice and related it to humans as to what cosmic rays, galactic cosmic rays, do to a human being. When you get above the Earth's atmosphere and you get out of the Earth's magnetic field, you're being bombarded with galactic cosmic rays. They're really potent, coming from supernovas, they believe. and you're also being bombarded with some very potent waves of solar wind from the sun, and particularly if the sun goes into an eruption while you're out there in the solar system. The total amount of radiation you're going to get on a trip to Mars is very significant, according to this article. As such, your mental capacities are going to be measurably decreased on a trip to Mars. And the ability to shield from that, or to use the right kind of pharmaceuticals to correct for that, right now, they don't think that that's possible. The only way you can shield from really potent galactic cosmic rays is a whole lot of very heavy material like lead. And you don't want to put a whole lot of lead on your spaceship. And they haven't found any chemistry, any pharmaceuticals that will correct for it. So that article right now is saying that there's some pretty serious challenges that have to be solved before human beings are going to go to a place like Mars. So, let's see how well we're hearing you tonight, Paul. WS2N, space report number 236, K2RIW.
Repeater, time out.
You've got it, Paul, K2RIW.
This is WS2N, yes, 236. And, as far as the expansion of space, I've heard a lot of these physicists on TV talking about that. I know the speed of light, you can't break the speed of light. Well, they said you're not breaking the speed of light. It's the space itself is expanding, so therefore, you know, these things are not moving away through space, you know, from one another. The space itself is expanding, you know. And instantaneously, it was like, you know, trillions of light years away from one another. It's a concept that has some validity to it. The space itself is expanding. Okay, I wanted to talk about Falcon 9 booster that landed on the autonomous ship last week from California Vandenberg Air Force Base that sent the 10 Iridium Next satellites into space, successfully came back and floated back to L.A., came into the port. Let me drop it. This thing is, over 150 feet high and about a little over 12 feet in diameter with 9 engines on the bottom of it, 4 landing legs sticking out, and it floats all the way back vertically. They don't lay it down horizontally, comes back like that. They weld the shoes over the legs, and that's how it comes back. Now it's off the boat, and it's going to be recycled, and it looks like it's in very pristine condition. So one of the reports I read is they might use it for one of the side boosts to the Falcon Heavy that will eventually go up. They're going to start launching Falcon Heavies probably this year from 39A, Launch Complex 39A in Florida. So, you know, Falcon Heavies are really one big Falcon 9 with two more Falcon 9s, one on the port side, one on the starboard side. They bolted together, and off they go with 27 engines on pushing it into space. So I'd like I wouldn't be surprised if it was like November or maybe even earlier. If things go right for SpaceX, let me drop it. Or they just might take the booster and just use it for a reflight. I know that's coming up probably about 2 or 3 flights from now. Also from Cape Canaveral, they're going to use the same launch pad that the Falcon Heavies are going to be launched from. Launch Complex 39A, and that's got a lot of history behind it. That's the complex that launched people to the moon. That's the one that first launched the space shuttles and eventually we'll and also put up a Skylab. It is now turned over to SpaceX, and they're converting it, and they will be using that. That will be the next launch. They say the end of the month, the end of this month, but I wouldn't be surprised if it floats into the beginning of February. But right now it's scheduled for the end of January. They plan on launching a geosynchronous satellite from that complex. So that's the update on SpaceX. Let me drop it. Before I go on about the rest of the SpaceNet report, I don't know if you still get Newsday, Dick. The paper today had an article that came out talking about the Catholic schools throughout Long Island, and the first couple of pages in this insert, in the Newsday, deals with ham radio contacts that are going to be made by one of the schools, St. Joseph's, which is a school my daughter is involved with. She's running that show over there, so that's going to be coming up in May. So on a break, do you still get news? Or do you read it on the computer, Dick? Back to you. WS to one.
I get Newsday, Paul. However, some kind of an error occurred in my delivery service, and it did not get delivered to me today. And I complained about it. They're going to deliver Sunday's Newsday to me tomorrow. Over to you, Paul. KQIW.
Very good. It wouldn't be on a computer anyway. They have these, and this is, it's almost like a magazine. It's probably about 20 pages. Glossy, heavy gauge paper. So it's very well done. You know, they're pushing the Catholic schools with maybe 10 different stories around the island. But the lead story is Ares, you know, the amateur radio on the International Space Station story, and dealing with my daughter's school, who is the she's handling the whole operation. The principal got involved, since she teaches science technology over there. She's a technology teacher. She got this project, and of course, being a ham, made everything go smoothly. So that's the update on St. Joseph's, and. My computer just turned dark here. WS2N. I wanted to go to sleep. Too early for the computer to go to sleep here. The other day was the election inauguration. So I thought maybe they'd mention something about space. There was a brief statement about space. But nevertheless, that night anyway, it. I think it was around 7:42. There was launch anyway from Cape Canaveral. The service, the space-based infrared system. This is like a $10 to $20 billion Air Force project. They have quite a few of these satellites. I think there's going to be a total of four in geosynchronous orbit, and a couple of other ones in polar orbit. And they have infrared detectors, and they'll be able to see any kind of launch worldwide by any kind of missile. So it's an early missile defense system. And that went off successfully from Cape Canaveral. Let's see, the launch complex. 41, the one that the United Launch Alliance uses. So that worked out quite well. and a lot of money's gone into this. And from what I read, that thing is successful, and it's going to work with all the other satellites in that program. And instead of just seeing, you know, one big intercontinental missile being launched, it could see one going from one area to another area. With, you know, say if they were going to launch one 100 miles.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
That was good to see. Let me drop it. And yeah, next launch coming up for the International Space Station. Going to involve one American and one Russian right now. They plan on only launching two people to the space station. But the Russians are dropping one. Usually they have three people go up at a time. Since they only need two Russians instead of three, they're doing less science now. There's now an empty seat. So our present plan is to fill it up with cargo, a couple hundred pounds, you know, whatever another human would weigh, around 220 pounds instead of cargo, human plus their spacesuit and everything else. So they'll have a little extra room for that. They're going to send some cargo up with the two astronauts. But now that might change in the very near future. They plan on doing this for the next year and a half, 2 years. Now it looks like Boeing is getting involved with NASA and looking to pay for their own seats. So there'll be empty seats, and Boeing might be able to get extra Americans on board the International Space Station. So, you know, maybe you'll have like three Americans and one guy from the European Space Agency and two Russians, that type of an arrangement. Looks like that could be a possibility. So I'll keep you informed. Right now there's still six people on the space station, but in about another month or two, once they start to reset the crews, you could wind up with possibly a five instead of six.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And that's pretty much it, Dick. So if you have any questions, comments, put in that. This is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet. Back to you, Dick.
My receiver system has come back to life. I found out what the error was. The cable had disconnected. If you have more people on the space station, that means the consumables you're going to go through faster. I think you're going to tell me they've got an ample supply of consumables. And I think you said that they make sure they've got the next 3, 4, 5, 6 months worth already on board. Otherwise, they start doing corrective action. For brief periods of time, during the days of the space shuttle, I think for brief periods of time, we had like 7, 8, or 9 people on board. What's the maximum number of people do you think they could put on the International Space Station, Paul, for even a brief period of time? And still have enough food, water, oxygen, bathroom space, and whatever. WS2N, K2LAW.
The most that were ever on board, I believe, was 13, and that was just temporary. You know, you had a crew of 7 astronauts that came up on the International Space Station. Then you had, I think there were probably 3 living there at the time, and then another 3 that were, you know, going to switch a crew out, and they had the extra port at the time for the Russians. It was somewhere around 12 or 13, you know, and that was very, you know, very short period of time, very unusual. I have a picture of them somewhere, the whole group of them together. So, but you know, the standard living situation right now is 6. For a long period of time. Well, in the beginning it was 2. on a regular basis. Then they got it up to three for quite a couple of years. And then they were going to go up to six. Let me drop it. And then Columbia happened. SDS, what is it? SDS 127? No, 107. SDS 107. When that burnt up in the atmosphere in 2003, that caused a problem. They weren't able to send up the shuttle. And it was only the Soyuz going up at the time and not that often. So they kept it at two for, I guess, about a year and a half, 2 years. And then when they got things going again, they finally brought it up to six on a regular basis. It's been like that for quite a few years now. So six is the regular number. And then once we get the private launches from Florida, you're going to have the Dragon going up. We'll be bringing four at a time. And Boeing will be bringing four at a time. You'll be able to have seven onboard stations permanently, That's the ultimate goal. And they feel by doing that, right now they're getting about 45 hours of actual science per week. So by having that extra guy up there, because his average working time will be about 45 hours, you're going to double the amount of science that you get out of the space station just by sending one more person. So that's pretty interesting. A lot of time is dedicated to maintaining or even building the space station. Russia is still planning on sending one bit more large module up, the MLM. Once they do that, then they can go back to their regular crew of three. And you'll have a permanent seven on board the space station. No matter what, once that module is finally sent up there. And it's a large module with another bathroom and everything. Back to you, Dick.
I think the maximum number of astronauts, cosmonauts, you've ever had on the space shuttle was seven. I guess a crew of six on the International Space Station combined the two, and I think that's where the 13 came from. And in that case, you've got at least one, maybe two bathrooms on the shuttle, and at least two bathrooms, maybe three, on the space station. But the silly question I've got here is, what's the total number of bathrooms on the International Space Station? And don't you sometimes get a failure of one of those, so you're down to at least one or two less? I've got a peculiar curiosity, as you can tell, because recently you've also had numbers like 1 million people in Washington watching the inauguration. And I don't think they had anywhere near the right number of porta-potties there. So human beings can't stop their body from doing what it's going to do. WS2N, K2RW, some crazy questions.
Yeah, for that one main reason. I'm not going to two locations. I'm not going to go on any of these Washington marches, and I don't see too many porta-sands there. And the other location is Times Square. They put you in these big pens. They close the pens, and that's where you're going to stay for the next couple of hours, no matter what. Unless you leave. You can leave, but you can't come back. They won't let you back in. That's always a problem. On the space station, you have two, one on the Russian side and one in the American side. So you're going to have one more once the multi-purpose laboratory module, the MLM, by Russia is sent up. So then you'll have three. But that won't be too bad. that, 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 that